So what I thought I would do tonight is I want to talk a little bit about my framing of renunciation and maybe open up your way of thinking about it a little bit so you're not so it doesn't get such a bad rap like renunciation usually gets. But what I really want to do is have a question and answer back and forth. I want to see what you already think about renunciation and see if we could talk about it. And just, I never really get to talk to you guys. I always end up coming like out of the blue and then I give a talk and then there's only like 10 minutes left. So I decided I really just want to talk to you about what you think about this idea of renunciation because renunciation is very, very, very important. It's very important. And our framing is going to determine how much respect or how much care we give it. So let's talk a little bit about this framing here. It usually when we think about renunciation, it's framed like we're losing something. We're giving up something. We're letting something go, something we want, and we're saying no to that. And in some respects, in a monastic life, renunciation is a lot like that. It is a lot like the letting go. I remember talking to this teacher, and I asked him about his monastic practice. Oh, it was so beautiful the way he described it. He wasn't planning on being a monastic. He just went to a retreat, fell in love with the Dhamma. We all kind of fall in love sometimes. Some of us do. And so he decided to go on this retreat during summer break. So he's going to go on the retreat in Thailand, in Asia. So he sent out all these letters. May I come retreat at your monastery? Nobody answered. Nothing. And then finally, this monastery in Thailand responded to him and said, "Yeah, come on, we'd love to have you." And so he goes, and when he got there, the abbot said, "You ordain tomorrow." And he was like, I think there's a miscommunication. I'm coming on retreat and then I'm going home." So there was like a little talk, like, "Why did you come to a monastery just to do a little retreat? Something's a little awkward about that." And so he agreed. He happened to be coming right when the rains retreats were starting, which is 3 months of seclusion because of the rainy weather. I guess it's nonstop. So they had these range retreats, and so it was starting the next day. And so the guy says, "Well, how about if I just do the range retreat? And then we'll see whether or not I'll ordain." And he was at the time getting his master's. And so he had some time, he took a sabbatical just to go do some retreating. So then he goes into the monastery, did his retreating, and he said he fell in love with the practice all over again. And so at the end of the range retreat, he said, "I'll ordain for like the rest of my sabbatical," which was another, I think, 6 months, 7 months. I think he had 9 months left. He had a year sabbatical. So I think he had 9 months left. And so he ordained for 9 months. And in this process of ordaining, he said that he had to keep letting go of stuff. You know, like we don't really let go of our friends. You know, we don't really let go of all this technology. We don't really let go of TV or all kinds of things that we use on a regular basis. We don't let go of things like that. But when you are ordaining in a monastic type order, Renunciation is a letting go of all the conveniences and the so-called necessities that we live with, and you're constantly letting go of it. And he described to me how beautifully the practice held it, but the pain of letting go of everything that you, things we take for granted right now, clothes we wear, I mean, you name it, certain foods, yeah, none of that anymore. There's so much that we let go of when you go into a monastic life. And sometimes I think in this practice, because it is a silent practice, we do do a lot of noble silence, we do a lot of retreating, we do a lot of framing like monastics do. But this is not monastic. And the more you understand, you are not taking on a monastic life just because you're a practitioner, then the more you can actually see the same beauty that the renunciation was practiced at this monastery for this teacher. It's the same practice in our lay life. We want to hold renunciation as a beautiful framing of practice, something that gives an uplift to our practice, not something that takes away, strips away, makes it barren. Why would anybody want to practice like that? I mean, for a monastic, if you've ever known any monastic, like if you go to Clear Mountain and you talk to Ajahn Nisipo or Kovalo, you can hear in their voice the beauty and the love and the holding that their practice is held in. Very beautiful. Very sweet. So even though they are renunciates, the practice they're holding is held in this container of brotherhood, sisterhood. It's held in a container of honor and nobility. But then we, as lay practitioners, we step into this renunciate kind of practice for lay practitioners, and it's held like a loss, like a giving up, losing something. It's no wonder that we don't want to do it. In fact, there was a lay person that went to the Buddha and said, you know, I like some of what you're saying. I like that practicing. I like the stillness. I like some of the stuff you're saying, the generosity, but it's when you start talking about that renunciation, you lose the mass. You lose everybody. Nobody wants to do that. We want to be with children and good food and fine clothes, and we want to have things and be with things. And the Buddha never looked at him and said, well, you're picking the lesser of the two ways to live. He didn't do that. He really said it was more in how you practice than it is your letting go, like paying attention to what you're practicing in. And he gave them some instructions on how to practice as lay practitioners. So one way we can begin to think about renunciation in this, I'm hoping that you're seeing that I'm pointing to using renunciation in a joyous way. This is the gift of your practice. It's a gift because nothing in Dhamma is set in stone. It's all impermanent. So everything about this practice is a gift for you to come to an understanding, to practice with, to see how it works out. You don't need someone to tell you, does renunciation work or not work, or am I doing good at this or not doing good at this? You already know. You can just look at your own life and you can see, oh, this is not working. This is working. This is not so good. You can see. So the practice itself is held in a framing of being a training mechanism. That's what this is. So for monastics, it's a training on how to live in non-attachment. And it's hard. And so they have all these factors that come into play to help support them to be able to do that. As lay practitioners, we need a framing on how we can put some kind of restraint on the flood of greed, the flood of hatred. It's just all consuming of us. So we have to do something to put a framing on this so that we can actually settle down the waters a bit, settle down the energy a bit, and we can choose the direction we want to go. If we don't put some degree of pause in our lives, then we are overrun by our minds. It gets overrun. It mostly gets overrun because, just imagine this. You have billions and billions and billions of cells in your body, just single cells. You have billions and billions and billions of germs, little organisms, bacteria. And on one hand, you could think, ugh! But on the other hand, you can begin to realize that the bacteria may have a different thought pattern than you do. Like, I like sugar. I think they like sugar, and I don't. It doesn't really work for me, but they like sugar. So they, because there's so many of them, they usually get their way, and I eat a lot of sugar. But it's not because I like sugar so much. So if I don't put some degree of constraint on them, then they will run my life. And they have. They do all the time. So in some respects, what makes us human beings in general are all of these single cells, bacteria, germs, all this energy within us that exists with wanting what it wants, preferences, wanting what it wants. Doesn't have anything to do with you or me. We all have bacteria. We all have little germs. They all want what they want, and it doesn't really have anything to do with you. And so we walk around with the power of that constant pushing against us. It shows up in our foods. Anybody will tell you the very thing you're intolerant of, the thing that you can't digest, the thing that you can't, it doesn't really help your body. That's what you want all the time. That's what you are trying to eat all the time. Knowing you shouldn't eat it, but that's what you want to eat. All of the energies that you have in your body from all the experiences you've had pushes against our minds, wanting to relive those good experiences and never have those bad experiences anymore. So it is pushing against us to act in accordance with this mind that thinks it knows the best way to go. If we don't put any restraint there, we are stuck in this being yanked around, misunderstood, deluded world, because we are not in the present moment. We are in the pushing of our preferences. That's the way we live. We are animals. You can look at, I have friends that have pets. Maybe not cats. I think they eat when the hell they want to eat. And they don't really care about you too much. But dogs, oh my God. You can barely put the food in the bowl before they scarf it down. I just can't believe how fast dogs eat. And they suck it up, and then they're done. They're kind of like looking like, is there more? And if there's no more, they'll go about their business. But just the hearing of the bowl and just the hearing of the food being put in the bowl, and that's it. They come and scarf it down. That is very impulsive. You can see it in pets that they're very instinctive animals, very instinctive, very impulsive, very reactive. We are animals. We do the exact same thing. But we have one gift, and it is truly a gift, this capacity to restrain, this capacity to actually withhold our actions on purpose, just to see how it is if we withhold it. Not out of some loss or force, but getting interested in what happens if I withhold something. So this renunciation practice, it's not, I mean, it's listed in the paramis. And the paramis are about opening the heart wide, opening our minds wide. They are not about closing us down, constricting us. They are about widening our capacity, broadening us out, making us wide and big so we can take on anything. So in this, there are two ways that you can look at renunciation. One, you can look at it like it is a sword. It cuts through the floods. It cuts through the I guess the just the pressure of habit energy, of just bacteria, germs, whatever the little cells are that likes the sugar, I cannot really stop them unless I'm practicing some type of renunciation. That renunciation is just this sword that says, I'm not going to do that. So when I go on retreat, I love, many of you know me, I love black tea with cream and sugar. Oh my God, that is just the best taste, and it has to have plenty of sugar. So when I go on retreat, all I want to do is sit in that dining room and drink black tea with cream and sugar because I don't have to do anything. So I just want to sit there and drink tea. But I have to put a restraint there on the body to not do that because it's not helpful for me or my practice. So that restraint that I actually put into place ends up helping me have the kind of retreat I want because of the restraint itself. So this restraint is like a sword. It cuts through the massive pressure and push of habit and helps us interrupt that. Not as a requirement that I cannot have tea. I could have tea if I wanted it. But it's more like it's more like this. Just imagine if we came out of sits with a horn or something. I mean the way some people hit that bell, it can be a little startling, but a bell is a much gentler sound. And the sound of the bell is interrupting our flow in the meditation. Wherever you're at in the meditation, you may be in peacefulness and you don't want the meditation to end, or you may be begging for that bell to hurry up and come. And so when the bell hits, you are just elated. Either way, the bell is interrupting, pausing our meditation, creating a transition. And that bell, the gentler it is in a sound, The gentler it is as a gift, the easier the transition. So this is kind of what renunciation does as a sword. It's like the bell. It's just a little kind of, just a little knock at the door, pausing a minute. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Are we sure we want to do that? Is that the best thing to do? Let's see. Wait, let's see. And it just kind of holds us in a framing that allows us to get interested in what happens when we restrain and what happens when we don't. There's no requirement to restrain. The actual renunciation is the right thought. It's called right. It's a part of the wisdom practice. So it's not wise view or right view. It's right intention. So the right intention is to restrain. And whether you actually restrain or not is not the issue. The issue is to have the intent to restrain so that you can see what happens if you don't restrain and what happens if you do. So the intention, it's more of the right intention to live a more restrained life in general. And how do we restrain this greed, hatred, and delusion? That we have to figure out, trial and error. So that's the sword side. And then there is this shield side. Because no one in this room is practicing at the level our altruistic heart wants to see us as. So we're like down here in the gutter, and we have this vision of what we should look like way up here in the skies. Very beautiful. We are not there. So if we don't have a framing of renunciation, then what we are left with is a judgment of how much we are not living up to our altruistic ideas. We would forever be grumbling at ourselves, fussing, forever. Okay, so some of us may already be doing this, but that's because you don't have renunciation in the framing. So instead, you are judging, comparing, and evaluating your practice against a standard that you are not at. That is the wrong standard to judge yourself as. So this renunciation as a shield, it by its very nature assumes you are not where you want to be, because that's why you have to restrain. So it adds this level of kindness and shielding, like a cloaking, a protection that's like we do when we swaddle babies. They are not adults, they are babies. So we look at them and we believe they're going to grow up and be some great being. But right now, what we're looking at is someone that can only barely hold the bottle and needs you to make that bottle every time. And they will let you know. But that's it. They can't really do much. They can pee. They can look at you, maybe, but that's very limited. So we have these little infants that are swaddled in these cloths to protect them from harm until they become adults, or they become, you know, the beings that they're going to ultimately be. And then for those of us that are parents, or even if you're a nephew, an uncle, or an auntie, or, you know, someone in your family has babies, then you watch them grow up, and there's a point when they're like, I got it. I'm on my own. I'm leaving. I'm going my way. This cloaking that renunciation does, it gives us the permission to not be quite right, to not be where we want to be, to actually give ourselves permission to work it out, to practice with it, to use a sword to help us. And the renunciation as a cloak is this right intention towards it. I mean, every time I come to a place in my life where I see some fault or failure or some failing or something that's not quite what I want it to be, I will set a vow that is inherent in some kind of renunciation. Not because I'm vowing to say, I'm not going to ever mess up anymore. Yeah, that would be not a good idea. It's more of a vow that says, I'm going to mess up, but I promise to keep at this. I'm going to mess up. I know I'm going to mess up, but I promise. I set this intention in kindness. We will keep at this. We will keep at this and keep at this and keep at this until we come to an understanding, until I can more easily be the way I really want to be. This is what renunciation does. It sets up the cloaking that gives us both the permission to not be where we are, to the permission, I guess, or the capacity to accept we're not where we want to be, and the permission to be where we are, steady ourselves with where we are. I remember one time, Venerable Panawati, who's coming in June, I cannot wait, I haven't seen her in so long. But Venerable Panawati one time said, she was giving some Dhamma talk, and someone asked her a question around renunciation. And her answer was, well, just set a vow. Say, in the morning, I vow not to do this. And she goes, and in the evening, check it out. Did you do it? You probably did. In the morrow, next morning, I vow not to do this. And then in the evening, you check it out. Did you do it? Probably did. Okay, next morning, vow not to do this. Every morning, vow not to do this. And she said, one day you're going to check it out in the evening, and you're going to say, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Just like that. I didn't do it. Because it's not you that has to stop your unskillful habits, your hatreds, your greed, your delusion. No one in this room can stop themselves from doing that. It stops because of right intention, this constant intention again and again and again, set over and over and over. And this renunciation is what's that supports that. So this is what our practice centers around, and it's not random that renunciation comes after generosity and ethical conduct. Because generosity at the beginning of the paramis, we are opening our hearts up. We are trying our best to open it up, open it up, open it up, open it up. In a world that says, don't open it up because it's too hateful out there. Let's close it down, close it down, close it down. And the Buddha's like, open it up, open it up, open it up. And of course, if you open it up, what do you think's going to happen? You are going to feel dukkha. You are going to have problems. You are going to notice just how painful the world is. And so this path, the first noble truth is the coming into recognition of dukkha, coming into the recognition of how painful it is to be human, coming into the recognition of all the add-on that we put on top of what is already a painful life, coming into the recognition of that. And as you begin to come into the recognition of that, which is the second paramis, this ethical conduct, beginning to learn what's ethical, what's skillful, what's the caring way to be, and noticing, ooh, I'm not like that. Oh, I'm not like that. What comes naturally is this cloak of protection to shield yourself, to reset this intention, to reset this letting go of the causes of dukkha, constantly letting go, letting go. And as you let go, you're going to get quieter, softer, freer. Not because you are making yourself quieter, softer, freer, but because the restraint itself actually helps support the mind to settle itself, to calm down, to quiet itself. It needs it the way children need to have some restraint, or their behavior will just. I mean, if kids could stay up all night, they would stay up all night, fall out when they get sleepy, next day, mean as hell, always snapping, crying, whining. They'd still want to stay up all night. I know, because my granddaughter was like that. Oh my God, I would beg that girl to go to sleep. No, she would not go to sleep. Not go to sleep. And then finally, her dad and I just decided, yeah, we've had about enough of this. We feel like we're the ones being, she's managing us at night. And somehow this has gotten flipped on its side. So we put some constraints on her behavior. And she didn't like it. And so she was very upset. But we held true to our little constraints. Okay, her dad sometimes, was a little sloppy with the boundaries, but that's okay. We pretty much had it. As long as grandma was around, we pretty much had the boundaries there. And gradually, she has a bedtime. She goes to bed. She gets up the next day. She's happy. She has good energy. So this restraint wasn't to harm her. It is to support her and to help her live more fully into the way she wants to be. This is what renunciation does for us. So, I think I've come to the end here. Get out this. If I get my, I'm going to end on this one little quote. Yeah. This is from Ian McCrory, his book. His book called "The Moon Appears When the Water Is Still." I actually am the quote I wanted to read. I like the one that's next to it on the other side. Hold on a minute. Yeah, no, I'll read this one. Our biggest problem is trying to solve our problems. Dhamma is not the way out of our problems. It is the way into them and through them. Meditation is a noun, not a verb, and often the most inspiring act is not acting. This very same thinking process that got us into this mess in the first place cannot now extricate us from our predicament. It's like trying to heal my burned hand by pouring scalding hot water on it. Our goal is not answers, but fewer questions. Be attentive, be present, be here, Now, all right, let's sit quietly for a second. We'll see what arises. Beautiful. So I left us a little bit of time here. It's 8:20. I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about maybe how you feel about renunciation, how you've been thinking about it over the course of this month. I mean, even if you haven't been thinking about it at all, what do you think about it tonight? That's good enough too. Just a way so that we can loosen up any kind of restrictive way around the idea of renunciation, even if it means like you think somehow or another you can't have a certain kind of, goal-oriented energy because you're just supposed to be in the present moment. Anything. So let's take a moment, see if anyone has anything they'd like to share. Oh, come on up. Almost, we're almost not going to have to. Oh, go ahead. We're almost going to have a moment where we no longer have to walk over to the mics. Maybe we can pass the mic, but that day is not tonight.
Thank you, as always, Tuare, for your talk. I think with renunciation, what I think about is how much effort I'm supposed to put in to resisting some urge. So for me, I'm sober, and I don't think that I could get there with lots of hard effort to give up drinking. For me, it had to come from a really aha moment when resistance completely dropped and the desire completely went away. And for me, that seems very different from kind of willpower or fighting really hard to have something happen. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about the play between being really intentional, like you said, and maybe making, like small tweaks to achieve some change in your life versus really needing to let go without, let go and not fight to have something happen, because it seems like kind of a delicate balance.
I swear that's exactly what I was trying to say. So whatever... however you put it, that's the framing we're going with, because that's the point I'm trying to make. The efforting to try to make yourself be some way is a thought pattern. It's the mind trying to use the mind to make yourself become something. And because the same mind is the mind that pretty much got us stuck, like in the addiction in the first place, it is not going to help us get out of it. It is going to tell us and remind us how badly we're doing at getting out of it. But when you let go of that force of will and you let it be about setting this, what the Buddha would call setting an intention. So in order for you to be sober, you have to constantly refresh this intention to be sober. Even if you were in and out of that process along the way, this intention you had to keep coming back to. So the coming back to the vow is a vow might be a harsh word, but It's really just this intention to stop drinking or stop using whatever it is. You had to have that intention refreshed and renewed over and over and over. It's the refreshing of your intention that actually supports your actions actually coming about the way you want them to be. And that to me is like you say, it is the opposite of this kind of force of will, making myself do something. In fact, that trying to make yourself do it is going to keep you trapped in the addiction for a long time.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, come on up.
So I've been practicing some renunciation the past few weeks, but I just wanted to ask, how do you decide what to renounce?
Well, I think that's a good question. So I just don't think there is anything that you have to renounce. But it's sort of like this. We're on this path for practice, whatever it is, even if it's no more than I want to meditate 15 minutes, I want to meditate 30 minutes every day. You're going to have to renounce something in order for that to happen. Otherwise, your natural inclination when you wake up in the morning is going to be, I can't do it today. We'll do it tomorrow. Okay. All the time. So there has to be, so the renouncing is not, giving up something. The renouncing is actually setting this intention to meditate. And in truth, you're not going to meditate every morning. Even if you say, I'm going to meditate every morning because I like it, you will not. But if every day you refresh this intention, you will begin to do it. Not because you forced yourself to do it, like the other gentleman was saying, not because you gave up something, but because the restraint of this intention to meditate and meditation, the fact that you go sit somewhere and be still, you have to give up something, even if it's just your time and the way you do things in the morning. You have to give up sleep. You have to give up something in order for that meditation to happen. And so what you're actually doing with renunciation is letting go of the actual force of will and instead being more diligent about the intentions you set. Do you see the difference? Because if you frame it as, what do I give up? Then you are going to start having a problem because you're going to look around your life and say, I probably should give up that, but that's like me trying to give up sugar. I probably should give that up, but I can't really give that up. But there's all this thought around, this is how I should be. This is what I should give up. And I'm trying to flip the switch a little bit here. So you think, set the intention of how you want to be. And the giving up part is going to come as you try to follow through on your intention.
Thank you.
You see? Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very beautiful. I have kind of the opposite problem sometimes.
You might have to hold the mic up a little
can
bit.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Okay. I have kind of the opposite problem sometimes. I went to a Vipassana, Goenka style meditation retreat. Loved it. And there's something very relaxing in my mental patterns about like restraint. It's very familiar. And I realize sometimes that I become addicted to the active controlling.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't find it difficult to give up like things that I've identified as vices, but it's very busy giving up. Like my mind is full
constantly
of
constantly giving
thoughts.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you help me?
Yes. Yes. Because I think what your mind is doing is it's giving up. It's thinking of the restraint itself, but you're not practicing within the paramis that opens the heart up. So it's not just the giving up. It's more what happens when you give up. What the Buddha said to his monastics, there's a story where they one time, you know, some monks were saying, well, our teacher teaches the same thing your teacher teaches. So what makes you so great? What makes Gotama, what makes your teacher so great, Buddha? And the monks didn't know. So they went back to the Buddha and they asked him, you know, you teach the same thing everybody else teaches. How come we're so free and they're not? And the Buddha says, I don't teach you the same information. I teach you how to discern, how to use that information. So this practice of renunciation, if it were just about giving up, then you're right. Your mind can control everything about you. It can give up, give up, give up, give up, give up. But it's not about the actual giving up. It's about seeing and discerning what happens when I let go of this. What happens if I don't let go of it? So it's in the actual ebb and flow of letting go, not letting go, of training with it intentionally. That's where the wisdom comes. And then you begin to discern the liberation that's possible and not controlling yourself. So you're actually opening your heart and opening your relationship with it. So anything your mind says, okay, we're going to let go of that, then your renunciation would be, don't let go of it. Keep doing it. See what happens if you just keep doing it. Mind says, okay, no more of that. That's exactly what you do every time. Just see what happens. It's like, because your renunciation is actually going to be not following this impulsive control that the mind can put on you. And that's what the protection and sword is about, is to help you with that, not whether or not you can restrain yourself. See that?
Yeah. I'm going to eat a lot of sugar.
You good. Look at you.
Thank you.
That's great. Finally, somebody gets to eat sugar freely. Yeah, come on. Adam, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Checking to see if there's any online hands up. Go ahead.
So I've been thinking about this over the month, and I've had some aha moments, but I want to check my framing and see what you think here. So I've been connecting renunciation with the concept that like dukkha is hot, like a hot thing that we pick up. And even when it's something that we crave, it burns us in a way. And renunciation, when you were talking about it as a shield, I was thinking, okay, this helps me wrap my head around why I've been connecting these two things. It's like that setting the intention that something that we keep picking up, even though it hurts us because we've got this pattern thought, we're actually, it's like an act of self-compassion to say, I'm going to notice every time I pick this up, or every time I don't pick this up. And that's the renunciation. That's the shield aspect, is just this, like, you know, this is painful. Even though I'm conditioned to do it, I even like doing it, it keeps burning me. And I'm never going to notice that unless I'm there with it every time I do it, or there with it every time I don't. Is that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, that's it. It's not the force of not picking it up.
Right.
It's the being willing to watch what happens when you pick it up and watch what happens when you don't. And watch what happens when you do and watch what happens when you don't. You're actually training the mind to notice that. And the mind, actually our minds, never want to harm us. So it's picking up this painful thing because it thinks this is actually the most liberating thing to do. So unless you actually let it see you, pick it up and feel what happens, and don't pick it up and feel what happens, and pick it back up and feel what happens, and don't pick it up and feel what happens, unless you train it to do that, it will just keep picking it up because it thinks this is the way to protect you. But when you do this training and use renunciation, this intention, as the training mechanism, then you can see, oh man, this is really hurtful. And at some point, the mind will not pick it up. Yeah. That's what controls our behavior. The mind will not want to pick it up on its own because it already knows that's painful. I'm not going to pick that up anymore. But mostly it doesn't know because we do things out of habit and we don't pay attention to the actual felt experience of our habits. And that's what you're doing. You're paying attention to it. It's very difficult to pay attention to yourself doing something that's otherwise painful. Because everything in our body system is like, that is not me. That is not me. Some alter person is taking over me and making me do this. This is not me. But no, this is you. You got to see that. And then gradually we begin to feel into what it's like not to do it. And then the freedom just comes from that.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody online that wants to ask anything? Kind of hard for me to see all you guys because I'm in this. There, switch that back. Anybody online want to ask anything? I see the online people must be good with renunciation. They got it all under control. Well, let me just ask everyone, do you have a sense that, can you see what I'm pointing to, that if you hold renunciation in a negative light, it will not help you? That you have to actually hold it in this positive, giftful light. Yeah, good. Is it Carla?
Yes. Hi,
Claire. Yeah, great.
I just want to offer like a little something I've been experimenting with in practice. So thank you for your talk, because everything you said and all the comments are just exactly what I'm struggling with the most right now. Like, it really hit home with what I'm practicing with and feels so valuable. And one of the things especially is what you said about both about having a vow and renewing a vow, and that we can't use the same thinking mind that's created the habit to keep ourselves from repeating the habit in a way, right? We have to try something different. So I sometimes listen to guided meditations with Joseph Goldstein, who I'm sure you know well. And yeah, one of the things he likes to do is offer these little like catchy phrases, like a word or a sentence that are, they're almost like little mantras. So one that I like is, be simple and easy, be simple and easy. So I've been because for a long time I was trying, you know, some resistance, some judgment, something would come out, and I was trying to just apply mindfulness. And I thought, you know, if I just observe it, try to not react, it'll dissolve. And sometimes it doesn't. It's like this tension just keeps growing. There are certain things that I wait and it still doesn't change. And maybe it will over time, but I've started experimenting with just like a positive vow, even like saying what I wish for. For example, you know, whatever, something comes up that I feel really reactive to, and I'll just tell myself, I choose kindness. I choose freedom. Or yes. Maybe simple and easy. And I've been noticing that that is very helpful sometimes. That is helpful in, I think, because it redirects me towards the positive intention I have rather than just focusing on don't do this. It's like, this is a beautiful vision of what I do want. And then I'm not tempted to get into an argument with my own mind. Like the moment I go into the story, it'll just, my mind will just be justifying and justifying, justifying. So it's a way for me to kind of just interrupt thinking with more just like a vision. So I'm just curious to hear what you think about something like mantras.
I think that what you're doing is renunciation. See, in order for you in a moment of reactivity to remember to be kind, to choose kindness, you're actually restraining this desire to lash back out. There's a degree of restraint that we are exercising. And that's why this word restraint is so bad. Sometimes English words in Dhamma are so bad. So the word restraint makes it seem like you have to force yourself not to do something. But the way you're framing it is so beautiful because the choosing to be kind is actually restraining from being reactive. It's just the choosing to be kind. And this is the protective nature of this quality of intention. It's setting this intention to be kind. And in truth, you can want to be kind and still not be kind. I mean, just keeping it real, right? We want to be and still not be kind. In Dhamma, you don't want to somehow or another poo-poo that experience. You want to use the experience when you set the intention to be kind, but you're not kind. You really want to be kind, but you're not kind. That experience is as important as if you choose to be kind and you are kind. Both of them in Dhamma are equal because both of them are helping you understand how to be. No, I shouldn't say helping you understand. Both of them are helping the mind understand how to be in the present day, not based on how you thought you should be when you were younger, but how you want to be right now. And both examples, whether you act out of kindness or not act out of kindness, you are training the mind to help the mind see what is the beauty of this. So, yes. The other thing that I think you said, what did you say? What did you say Joseph's mantra was?
Be simple and easy.
Simple and easy. Simple and easy. That is yes, very good. So Joseph, he's so clear and cuts through. Because if you think about it, most of our lives, we have this running commentary of some complicated mess of how we have to make ourselves get into these positions to be a certain way. And this idea of being simple and easy, can you see the restraint that has to happen in order for us to be simple and easy? There's a degree of restraint, even though when the mind begins to feel into that simple and easy, it will like that more because the mind likes contentment. Even though it's always caught up in all this drama, it's really the reverberation of shaking a snow globe. And you shake it, something happens, and it gets caught in all of this like shaking, and it can get caught in all of that energy, and it will not rest. But what it wants to do is for you to put the snow globe down and let all the sediments settle to the bottom. That's what it wants. And that's why when we go on retreats and we actually find that tranquility and get right there in the midst of it, even on a day of mindfulness, by the afternoon, you can feel the room getting settled. And in that settled, our minds get happy. Even though they may not be totally quiet, they're happy with the felt sense of tranquility. And so the settling, being simple and easy, that's coming from this this kind of restraint from getting caught up in the mind story, the way you describe it. The restraint is, I'm not going to go in that story. Just going to keep it simple and easy, not going into the story. And sometimes you're going to go in the story, and sometimes you're not. But you're going to feel it either way. What is it like when I go in the story? What is it like when I don't? And both of them is the nature of renunciation practice.
Yeah, you know, I also feel like, you know, the mind likes certainty. So these phrases really convey a sense of authority. And I'm still feeling out, it feels like, you know, more of a psychological method. I don't know if it's strictly Dhamma and practice, but it's effective because it's like, oh, here's someone with authority, awareness, telling the mind what we're doing now, and then it can stop, you know, trying to figure it out itself.
Oh, yes, it is definitely Dhamma. There are 84,000 objects you could put your attention on. So that's just one object. The phrase, keep it simple and easeful, you know, and easy. That's a phrase you could put your attention on that. That's definitely Dhamma. The place where Dhamma comes into play here is the Buddha always treated the presence and the absence of something the same. So whether you go to the story or you don't go to the story, it's the same. There's not one better than the other. And in that, you just want to see what happens to you when you go to the story, what happens when you don't. It's okay either way. You want to learn from the experience itself. And the more you learn from the experience, the more your mind will choose to not go to the story, simply because it just doesn't want the headache.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, is that it? This was really, really good. I'm not sure if we have announcements today, so I want to check. Make sure I don't run out of time. It's my usual. All right, good. Maybe we have actually more time. We actually may leave early, which is very shocking. So something has happened. So anyway, I hope you can hear these like final comments here. I hope you can hear that we're setting us up for where we're going into the next paramis. Because the next paramis is wisdom. And can you hear how this practicing with renunciation, watching what happens when you renounce and when you don't, when you restrain and when you don't, watching all of that is actually leading to this wisdom, this beginning to understand the Four Noble Truths, dukkha, the nature of the three characteristics, all of this. We can begin to understand it. So we are just in the first four paramis, and yet you can begin to see that if you begin to perfect these various energies, your practice itself grows. If your practice is going to awaken, not because you make yourself sit every morning, but because you want to see what happens when you sit, what happens when you don't, what happens when you sit, what happens when you don't. And all of a sudden, the practice itself gets interested, and we can actually talk to each other about it like we're doing. And it's not just something you're trying to do to make yourself a better person. You don't need to make yourself a better person. You're fine the way you are if you just settle and accept when you're acting skillfully and when you're not. and then begin to see. All right? Well, thank you so much for your attention. I appreciate everyone here. It's very nice. I always love it when I'm here and I get to be with you. My fingers are crossed that the next time I'm with you, we are downstairs. That's where the finger crossing is. But we'll see. Maybe it'll be a little bit longer. Anyway, thank you all for coming. I appreciate you. Don't forget the Donna, even for Sims. You know, I don't hardly ever talk about Donna in a community setting, but it's great that we're actually going to open up our space and be in our own space. But we are going to pay for that in a way that is more than paying rent when you just use the evenings. So don't ever forget about Sims. And just don't ever forget about making sure that our ability to keep coming together and being together and talking about this and strengthen everybody's practice, that we don't ever lose that opportunity. All right? Great. I think it's in May, mid-May. This is when I'm going to be here. So that's when I think our time is going to be. So I think it's just about a month away. Yeah, might be mid-May, like May 12th. If that's when we can do it. I hope so. I'm very excited. If not, it'll be June. All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate you all.